Thank you for downloading this APGRD podcast.
This is a recording of the playwright Marina Carr in conversation with the APGRD's Fiona McIntosh in October 2015.
We'd love to hear what you think, so tweet to us at APGRD.
Or visit us at www.apgrd.ox.ac.uk for news of our upcoming public events.
Good afternoon, everyone. And I'm sorry, I'm standing here looking as if I'm just about to, head a rock concert or something. We, for some reason, have a shortage of lapel mics that don't have horrible kind of feedback, spillover, whatever you call it. So I'm forced to clutch this while Marina at least has, is the sound okay, Tom? Yeah. Is forced, or at least is comfortably. I think it might be your wonderful hair.
Oh, it's my hair. Yeah.
It's my heart.
It must be your heart.
I do have it.
I want to begin by welcoming Marina back to Oxford, because as I'm going to sit down, sorry, many of you who are old friends of ours will remember Marina did join us sometime,
9 years ago.
But, well, you know, okay,
yes.
Right. Many years ago, before actually we returned to this building, this wonderfully refurbished building that is now Oxford Classics, we were temporarily in the old school, old boys' school in George Street, in a rather shabby, comparatively shabby common room. And I remember in those days, Marina talked so warmly, so generously, so openly about what was then her only play that had engaged to date with the Greeks. And many of you will know that's the extraordinary By the Bog of Cats, which has enjoyed a quite outstanding revival at the Abbey in Dublin this summer, which I was really privileged and so delighted I went over to see. So it's really very much a welcome back, and it's welcome back many years ago in the old boys' school when we had our first conversations. That has really been the beginning, I think, of a long association between the APGRD and Marina. And we've watched Marina not just look at Medea, but engage, as you will know, with the Iphigenia and Aulis, the Oresteia through her play Ariel, then went on to work on Phaedra backward, and most recently, and of course, the reason for today's event, the Hecuba. Now, this afternoon, our focus will be Hecuba. And Marina suggested, which I think is an excellent idea, is that she begins with a reading from the play before we will then go on to have an informal kind of conversation, and one that we hope very quickly will include you all, and so there will be plenty of opportunity for questions. So Marina, over to you.
Okay.
And your reading.
Okay, so I thought I'd read from the opening section, which is Hecuba, and then Agamemnon joins her. It should be self-explanatory, so here goes. Scene 1, the throne room, Hecuba surrounded by her women. Hecuba, so I'm in the throne room, surrounded by the limbs, torsos, heads, corpses of my sons, my women trying to dress me, blood between my toes, my sons' blood, 6 of them, 7 of them, 8, I've lost count. Not that you can count anyway, they're not complete. More an assortment of legs, arms, chests, some of the armour still on, some stripped, hands in a pile, whose hands are they? Ears missing, eyes hanging out of sockets, and then Andromache comes in screaming, holding this bloody bundle. My grandson, intact except for his head, smashed off a wall like an eggshell. They're through the south gate, she says. They've breached the citadel. They're here. I say, put him with the rest, put him beside Hector, his father's mangled body. She won't stop screaming, shut up, I say, and draw them on us. I tell the women to cover her mouth. We have no soldiers to protect us, all dead or still fighting, trying to save their own women and children. and I don't know where Priam is. He went out a while ago. When was it? Last night? Yesterday? My women are putting perfume on me. Perfume. I swat them away. The smell of blood wading in it, the tang of rotting bodies everywhere, bodies that came out of this body, and I want to vomit, but there's nothing in my stomach. They've cut off our food supplies. And Cassandra's standing at the throne, that smirk on her face, I told you so, did I not tell you so, and I could kill her right now. And Polixena looking at me, petulant, willing me to turn this around, make it all right, make sense of it, and I'm glad at least my little Polydorus is safe, we've sent him to Thrace away from all this. And then a soldier comes reeling in the door, Priam's head in his hands, my husband's head. They beheaded him in the great sky god's temple. I said, where's the rest of him? What good is a head? We can't bury his head without the rest of him. And the soldier says, I don't know, they've burned the temple, burned the temple. The whole city's in flames, he says, and he puts Priam's head into my hands. I sit on the throne holding it like a baby, his tongue's hanging out, his eyes are terrifying, ferocious death. I try to close his eyes, they're caked with blood, crust, dust, I can't close them. And the soldier is weeping on his knees, holding my ankles, all the men castrated, he says. Not enough to kill them, must desecrate them too. And I say, the women, what about the women, the children? The women too, they're killing the women, he says. All the old ones, the ugly ones, the ones past childbearing, past work. And the children, I say. Priam's head is oozing onto my dress. The children, he says, all the boys and all girls under 10. Why, I say, though I know it's a stupid question. Not enough room on the ships, he says. They're rounding them up, have them in the cattle pens. And I think this is not war. In war there are rules, laws, codes. This is genocide. They're wiping us out. And then there's shouting, clashing of swords, more screams. And Agamemnon is in the throne room. Agamemnon. Fabled queen, I say. She hears the mockery in my voice, though it's not complete mockery. I've been wanting to get a good look at her for a while. And there she is, perched on her husband's throne, holding what? His head. The blood flowing down her arms, and what arms they are, long and powerful. What's that, I say? She doesn't answer, just looks at me as if I'm a goat herd. The snout cocked, the straight back, 3,000 years of breeding in that pose. Thank you. They told me many things about him, this terror of the Aegean, this monster from Mycenae, but they forgot to tell me about the eyes, sapphires, transcendental eyes fringed by lashes, and a girl we killed for. I pretend I don't know who he is. And you are, I say. You know damn well who I am, he laughs, and you may stand, Agamemnon. And she says she'll stand when she feels like it. So I lift her off the throne. Now that wasn't too difficult, was it, I say. I can't resist twirling her, though I know I should show more respect. Used, but good, still good. I was expecting an old hag with her belly hanging down to her knees, but she's all right. There's bedding in her yet. I wonder if she still bleeds, will I ask? No, not no. Leave her. She's lost everything. She's a queen. Was a queen. Behave yourself. Hecuba, God bless you, he says as he twirls me. God bless you, but war is hard on the women. He smiles at Cassandra. Cassandra smiles back, the little trollop. So you're the man set his daughter's throat to change the wind, I say. Agamemnon, and the wind changed, I tell her. The wind changed. Hecuba, and I wonder what sort of wife he must have, this barbarian who calls himself king. Agamemnon, and she's looking me up and down. She has an eye on it. 18 children, I'm told. I wonder if they're all Priam's. I wouldn't mind making the son with her. Only way to sort a woman like that out is in bed, take the haughty sheen off her, the arrogance, even while she's skidding in blood, stepping over corpses, the lip curling. This is my husband's head, she says, brandishing it at me. He didn't even have the decency to give me back his body. Hecuba, these are the remains of my sons, I say, pointing to the dung heap of limbs, heads, hearts, necks I loved and kissed. I have to bury them, I say. Agamemnon, my men will take care of it. I see the corpse of an infant. Who's that, I say? Hecuba, Scamandrius, Hector's day. Agamemnon, I thought his name was Astyanax. Hecuba, no, Scamandrius. Why do you want to know? Agamemnon, I wonder, did Hector have two sons then? These Trojans, so sly, can't have any of them alive. Where's the boy, I say? What boy, she says. You know what boy, I say. Polydorus, your boy, your last boy. Hecuba, I don't know. Agamemnon, you know. Hecuba, he's 9, he's a child. Agamemnon, children grow up fast. Last thing I want is Trojan sails on the wide Aegean, your boy at the helm. Hecuba, he's no threat to you. Where is he, says. Can see the anger rising in him. A man of sudden rages can't be thwarted. I must be careful. Priam sent him away for safekeeping 6 months ago, I say. I don't know where. Scarborough's Journey, Polydorus, they're going to take you to Agamemnon. You know well where he is, and the longer this business goes on, the worse it will be for you. And she starts crying, please, she whispers, please, her face crumpling. I've seen that look before on my wife's face, and they made me drag Iphigenia from her arms. But I can't let the boy live, this is war, these things have to be done. Don't you have children, she says, I have lots of children. The daughters are stunners, can see the mother in them, what she must have been in her prime. Not that I mind the old hens have a weakness for them, all said. And bored to the nostrils of girls these long years, they know nothing, understand nothing. For the look in this one's eye when you're on top of her, I give plenty to see that look, hostile, weighted, challenging, then transported once I get to the animal in her. The young ones won't reveal that, think it's all flowers and moonlight and concealing. Think they've all of time to declare themselves, but this one is starlight. Might take a while to get her down, willing, but by God, when you did, magnificent in the sack, I'll wager, and I'm really wrong with these matters. And I say, we'll find them, whether you tell us or not. And she's muttering at the children, why are you killing the children? Sell them as slaves on Lesbos, Lemnos, so we can ransom them, their children that done nothing. My husband's body, she says, walking round in circles. This is too much. She has to bury them all with her own hands if need be. Hecuba, my husband's body, where is it? Agamemnon, I tell her there's no time. She has to get on the ships, but she's not listening. She's losing it. We're evacuating Troy, burning it to the ground, this city of liars and rapists. She's listening now, turns on me, blood rising, hands shaking with rage, goes into a reel. Spittle on her lips as she gives vent. You came as guests, she hisses. Hecuba, you came as guests, rolling in here, stinking of gold ship and mackerel. And you came with malice in your hearts. You saw our beautiful city, our valleys, our fields, green and giving. You had never seen such abundance. You wanted it, you must have it. You came to plunder and destroy. I remember she rattles on about their paved streets, their temples, their marble libraries, their holy Joe priests. Their palaces of turquoise and pink gold. I say, where's Helen? We can't find her. Hecuba, Helen, Helen. Helen was never here, and well you know it. Agamemnon, you have to admire her, the brazen stance. I say, you stand here, everything lost, and still you lie. Who is this Helen, she says. And if she could get her hands on her, she'd tear her asunder. To enter a man's house, I say, to bed his wife, to kidnap her, to kill her, to do away with the evidence. We want Helen back. We have our dead to bury too. Hecuba, Helen does not exist. You made her up. You needed a reason to take her up. There is no Helen. There never was a Helen. Yeah, 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 he says. That's your version. Cassandra snorts, plays with her bank and stares at him. We need a treaty, I say. I must calm down, say what I can. We need to hammer out a treaty. Agamemnon, now you want a treaty. The little prophetess is wearing the bracelet I sent her. Young, far too young. The other girl glares, I know she's no innocent, gave many happy hours with the bold Achilles. Way past time for treaties, my good lady. I tell the soldiers to round them up, get them on the ships. I'm going nowhere, she says, till I bury these. She waves her hands helplessly. The place is an abattoir. Hecuba, his men will do it, he says. I know they won't. And then he sits on Priam's throne. I ignore the outrage. I say, these are my women. They've served me faithfully. They mustn't be harmed. Okay, he says, keep them near, it's wild out there. He's making himself comfortable on my husband's throne, clicks his fingers, his men produce what? A goblet in the shape of a lion, pour for him. He sits there, legs apart, looking at me, drunk on his success. Never thought he'd see this day, we never thought so either. He's got what he wanted, Priam, your throne, your head at his feet. I say, I have to have my things packed, I'll inform him when we're ready to depart. He says, I like your cheek. Agamemnon, you'll inform me of nothing. Different rules now. Everything is in my gift. Show me your gratitude. And he offers me his hand to kiss. Now he's being ridiculous. Come, girls, I say. Andromache, she's holding her dead baby. My darling little grandson, leave the baby, I say. She won't. Leave him. And she comes and takes my hand. Agamemnon, I'll excuse your bad temper on account of the days in it, I say. Bury them together, she says, find my husband's body as if I'm her slave. If you don't do this, your own death will be terrible. Hecuba, you putting a curse on me now, he says. If I had the gift of curses, take them to my ships, he says. You mean my ships, I say. Agamemnon, she refrains from spitting, just about. No, mine, I say. My black ships. Where are you taking us, she says. Hecuba, home, he says. Home. And the soldiers lead us out, and there's crushing, swelling, shouting. Someone pulls at me, the soldiers pushing back, they whoop and leer. His men put up their shields to protect us, Polyxena clings to me. Cassandra walks through them like she's walking into a field in May.
can I start, Marina, just by, before we talk specifically about your Hecuba, I'd really like to hear you to talk about, well, why the Greeks, and why the Greeks so seemingly regularly now in your work.
Yeah, I don't know if this is working, but I'm going to talk anyway, and if you can hear me, if you can't hear me, just say shut up. Why the Greeks? The stories are fantastic. The contradictions are wonderful. The purity, the cleanness of the arc of the plays, the bareness of them, the complexity of the women. There are huge roles for women. You don't get that very often in theatre. You get it in Shakespeare, you get it in the Greeks, you get it in some of the modern classics, you get it in Ibsen, you get it in Tennessee Williams, you get it in Strindberg. It's not something you get a lot now. So that's a huge attraction. Why else? I suppose because, and I've been thinking about this a lot because I've written a lot of plays where I make up the plots myself. And sometimes then I think you need to go to an older set of ideas and values and just re-examine and see how they implicate us now. And then sometimes, of course, you have to, you do the whole thing yourself, plot and character, whatever. But I think it's very hard to, even when you attempt to have an original plot yourself, it's very difficult to get away from these mythic stories and these, I suppose, their pulse and the heartbeat and the hard wiring of theatre as we know it. It's all in them.
Great. And I suppose anyone who has seen your Hecuba, and those of you who would have heard it, will have recognised that there's an extraordinary generosity of vision, and in some cases quite a surprising generosity to villains over, you know, 2.5 millennia, not least, of course, or rather particularly, I suppose, Polydorus.
Polymestor.
I mean, precisely, yeah. Polymestor, yeah. Which was quite extraordinary. But of course, would you like to tell us something about this generosity of vision? Is this something that you're in any way conscious of as you write?
Well, I don't know. Well, it's very nice of you to say generosity of vision. I suppose if there is any, it comes out of a reading of the myths, what has been written down, the plays as written down, and I suppose the realization that they were myths at the time that the Greeks were writing these plays and trying to start a country, trying to start the polis, try to invent law. Nietzsche famously said the reason they invented all these things was because they had to, because they hadn't a clue what law was or what civilization was. How should one behave? And then reading the plays and disagreeing at times with what's put there, particularly in Hecuba, it's Hecuba we're talking about. I could never really buy the ending. And then, I mean, when you're dealing with myth, it's very hard to establish motive and genealogy and all of that. It's all kind of up for grabs. But just looking through it and the many conversations I had with you and with Edith Hall, and Fiona and Edith have been talking to me for about a decade trying to educate me. So it's all their fault. Just that, you know, okay, it's difficult to establish any fact around a myth. But there are a couple of things, I think, instinctively that you can kind of sniff out. And I just disagreed. I mean, I disagree with a lot of the way the RSDI is written as well. I disagree with Hecuba. I disagree with Medea. I disagree with them all, actually. And I think they're all fantastic creations. But they are creations. I suppose that's the thing. I think we tend to be quite timid in front of classic literature, and particularly the Greeks. And I suppose one of the things is discovering that they're not that remote from us at all. We haven't changed. We actually haven't changed that much. And once you realise that we haven't changed that much, it's very easy to read psychology. And it's very easy to interpret a set of circumstances and how it may have fallen out. So, for example, the most obvious thing in Hecuba is she doesn't kill her grandchildren at the end. She doesn't kill Polymestor's children. She doesn't blind Polymestor. And just when I was looking at that, I mean, it always kind of niggled me. With Medea, you can see why she did kill her children. There's absolute motive there, and the connection, the blood connection, is so, it's so severe and so strong and so immediate. I can understand that, and I completely believe that. I've never believed that Hecuba could have done that. So I had to examine why I couldn't believe that and come up with an alternative set of circumstances that it could read as another possibility. What I have to keep remembering is the three big tragedians, they were also making everything up. It was on a wing and a prayer, it was on the hoof, it was for the big competition. So yeah, I don't know if that answers.
Yes, I think that's very helpful, and in some ways you've anticipated what my next question is, and I think a number of people in the room are very interested, not just in the genesis of this play, but also how the play developed, during
rehearsal.
Yeah. And I know that rehearsal, or at least development on the play, began at least 2.5 years ago,
yeah,
with the RSC. So would you like to, give us a little idea?
I was working on another play for the RSC, and I don't know what it was. It didn't work. But they said, come over for 2 weeks and we'll just talk and we'll get some actors together and we'll get a director together and we'll just read some plays. And one of the plays I wanted to read was Hecuba. So we spent a week working on this other play that I was writing, which I still haven't figured out what it's about. It's just a coffin on stage and people getting in and out of a coffin. It's kind of quite absurd. I mean, I liked it, but nobody else likes it. So I said, okay, let's read Hecuba. So we read Hecuba, and then Fiona and Edith came along to speak to us for a day, to speak about all things around Hecuba, and just to talk to us about the Festival of Dionysus and about Greek theatre, and very inspiring stuff, and fascinating in detail. You know, the hook for, because I'm not an academic, the hook, I make things up. That's what writers do. You make things up and you hope they're true things you make up, or that there's some slant on the truth. But the detail we got from the conversation that day, myself, the director, the actors, reading Hecuba and then having Fiona and Edith just talking about Greek theatre, it just brought the whole thing alive. It made it seem very, very present and very contemporary. And it sort of gave me a fulcrum and a setting to begin to think about Hecuba as a contemporary woman. So the sound of it, the sound of her, how she would think, how she might feel, the other characters. It was fascinating as well just getting short biographies on each of the characters in Hecuba, and the slant and the bias by which they were written of at the time. So for example, Agamemnon, the Greeks hated Agamemnon because he was a Spartan, and they were at war with the Spartans around the time all these plays were being written. And if I'm correct, it was the Spartans who got rid of the Greek state in the end, wasn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. So So obviously, portrayal of Agamemnon is going to be completely biased. Obviously, Clytemnestra's portrayal is going to be hugely biased, because she's another Spartan. Polymestra, then, the Thracian, stuck in the middle. If you think of people in a war situation, it's a bit like Poland, really, in World War II. Everyone's racing across Poland and tearing to shreds, but nobody cares about Poland. It's about the other powers. So that was an interesting thing to look at. The fact that the Polymestra's boys would have been related to Hecuba was another thing that kind of decided it for me. Grandmother killing her grandchildren. There's something about that removed generation that I find really difficult. Maybe there probably are grandmothers who killed their grandchildren, but I think you'd be hard put to find them. It just didn't ring true dramatically, or it didn't seem true to character. It seemed to me more like a piece of propaganda for the new, very fragile Greek state at the time these plays were being written. I suppose the other thing that we all have to remember is all these big Greek women like Phaedra, Medea, Clytemnestra, Hecuba, they're all outsiders. None of them are from the Greek state. I suppose what's commendable is that the women are included at all in the discourse, even if it's only metaphorically, it's in the writing. But they couldn't have a Greek woman behave like that, it seems, at the time. It would have been too threatening for the state. But they needed to deal with the feminine and how they were going to cope with the feminine in this new city-state, and where they were going to find a place, how they were going to define men and women and culture and how to live. But you couldn't have a Greek woman behaving like Hecuba or Medea or Phaedra, but you could have a woman who was from the outside as a kind of a cautionary tale. So this is what women do when they get angry, or when they get power, or when they want power, or if things don't go their way. And it's quite, they really are cautionary tales of how not to be a woman. But for a woman, I think for women down the ages, yes, they are cautionary tales, but they're far more than that. It's almost like they're the outward limit of definition of what a woman is, or what a woman can be, or how far a woman can go within a political model that is controlled by men. So that's always been fascinating.
I'm interested in the way that you were exploring the sort of multiplicity of perspectives that you say we have on Athenians and Spartans and Greeks and Trojans. I'm sure many people would agree with me that in some ways what you seem to have done in your play, consciously or not, is actually sort of almost out Euripides himself, because Euripides is famously known as the playwright who gives you a particular perspective on a character and then unsettles you in a subsequent scene by giving you another perspective on that character. And, you know, in early scholarship, that often was deemed to be, you know, kind of bad playwriting. But then increasingly people, in the light of kind of particularly modernist plays, realised that there was something very sophisticated that Euripides was doing. And what you do, it seems to me, in your play, and maybe we will hear more from you, what you were doing formally, shifting as you do between first person, second person and third person, absolutely extraordinarily complexly, and I think that the actors clearly rose brilliantly to that challenge in Stratford, but it clearly was an incredible challenge. But I wonder where these formal innovations came from. I remember actually in rehearsal saying, getting terribly exciting and saying that you were epicising tragedy, that this was a kind of epic tragedy through the use particularly of the third person. But I wonder if you, I mean, it would be really important, I think, to hear from you, because I'm absolutely certain, and I mentioned this to you before, that in 20 years' time, people are going to look at this play as an extraordinary achievement in formal terms. I mean, amongst other things, but I do think what it's done formally is amazing. And I suppose I want to say, where has that come from? I mean, I've identified it as taking Euripides further than Euripides ever went. But also, I wonder where else this amazing stylistic inspiration came from.
Yeah, it is an interesting one. Because, you know, like most playwrights, you write and then other people come along and tell you what you've written. You don't really know yourself. You're writing. And sometimes I think that's enough, really. That my job as a playwright is to write the plays and other people's job is to come along and interpret them. But I do remember, a couple of things I do remember in the writing of that play. And it was more to do with my own frustrations with the limitations of the traditional style of playwriting. By that I mean, you are writing for the theatre is so bald and it's so out there that sometimes you miss, or I have begun to miss, subtext and the idea that we say one thing, we believe another, we feel another, and we do another. So you have a person on stage and they're stuck with the line, what they have to say. So you don't get to hear what they're thinking or what they're feeling, which may be the very opposite of what they're saying. And the limits of performance, a great performer can give you a taste of that, but they can't give it all to you. So I was trying to find, I suppose, a way to do that in the line, in the language. So the I say, she says, we say, you say, whatever, that, and they're taking one another's lines. And I wanted it in the continuous present. So if you look at the play, there's nothing in the past. It's all happening as it's being spoken. So it's unfolding as it's happening. So that was important. I don't know why it was. I didn't want anything recorded about it. And some of the people said, oh, the reported speech. I disagree. I don't think there's any reported speech in it. But that's me. That's me. Because I don't think it's reportage. I think it is something about a drama unfolding as it comes out of their mouths, as they're thinking the opposite, as they're taking other people's lines. So really, that was out of my frustration with just the traditional form of playwriting. I suppose the other thing that is fascinating about the Greek plays is the chorus. I think we all have, well, I have great difficulty with the chorus. I love the chorus. But how to make the chorus dramatic and how to make the chorus sing today, I think is hugely problematic in the staging of Greek theatre. So I was determined I wasn't going to have a chorus. But I think actually what I've written is everybody is everybody else's chorus, just by whatever the form is. Now I have to declare myself, I had absolutely no idea that's what I was doing. That's just the way it came out. But you did ask me before as well about the rehearsals and finding a way to do this. Erica Wyman, who's directed this at the Swan in Stratford, one of the most difficult things was how do you stage this? You know, because it conjures up this world, like, you know, these rooms of turquoise and gold and, you know, these sacrifices and there's blood everywhere and there's dead bodies everywhere and there's dead children everywhere and there's love affairs and there's seductions and there's all sorts of things. There's blindings. How do you stage that? And I think she came up with, I mean, when you write a new play, you've no idea what it is until it has its first production, really. Nobody knows, least of all the writer. But I think her instincts were absolutely spot on, just very pure. Very straightforward, very simple, which puts tremendous pressure on her as director and puts ferocious pressure on the actors, because it needs incredible concentration. You need to carry, you have to carry what you're thinking and feeling and saying yourself. At times you have to carry and think what the other person is thinking and feeling. At times you have to deliver their lines. At times you have to deliver their lines with their slant. At times you have to deliver their lines with your slant. At times you have to deliver their lines just very coolly, with no bias. So the choices and the permutations within that, it might look very simple, but it was actually an incredibly complex thing to land. There was really, really detailed work done with all of those actors on how to deliver this and how to make it still be a play, because that was the other thing. It's not a monologue. It's not fiction. It is a play. It was a huge challenge. But I mean, she had one bowl. She had a little bit of black blood. She had a throne. She had a dagger, and that's it. And all the actors. That was it. So it was up to. I think it has. It puts a lot of demand on the audience. The very nature of that. You have to listen and you have to watch. And there are the couple of performances I sat in, it was fabulous. You know, people are moving forward and forward and forward as the night goes on. They're just listening and they don't want to miss anything. And that's a lot. Of course, you have some audience, you've been somewhere, and they're just coughing and spluttering and, you know, whatever, going out for drinks of water. But most of the time what you have are an audience just, you could hear a pin drop, because it demands that kind of concentration.
I think... what struck me, particularly in Derv Lakrotti's performance, was how you began with, as you say, a delivery that involved these fused perspectives and actually fleeting perspectives. But increasingly, Dervla finds the first person. And the first person then dominates. And as you say, the night I saw the play as well, the audience, as they were increasingly let into her story, were, as you say, literally taken in, visibly so, in their seats. I'm interested in what you have to say about chorus and how, in some ways, the shift between first, second, and third person, and particularly... the moment very often of the third person, which was directly directed to audience as chorus would. In some ways, Erica, perhaps maybe you, and in conversation with Erica Wyman, clearly felt that there was an aural dimension that should be added to this piece. And I think one of the most haunting things about the production was the extraordinary voice of Lara, the singer.
That was Erica. Erica wanted some music, so one of Hecuba's serving women is also a singer. And Isabel Waller-Bridge composed this score for her, and it is absolutely beautiful. But that was Erica. I suppose the other thing that I didn't know as well, and it was Erica's and the performers, gradually realizing that this play can only work if it is absolutely consciously given to the audience. By that I mean looking audience in the eye and delivering lines to them. And all of the actors have been really brave about that, but it takes tremendous courage to do that. And I have to say, the audiences have been fantastic. There's no one looking at their programme when an actor is giving them a line. They're all there looking back and giving it back. And it's what we all know instinctively when theatre works best. It's a transaction and it's a relationship between audience and performer. And it's those waves of energy going forward and back. But I think particularly, you can't pretend, you know, there's a fourth wall there with this one. It's absolutely. And those of you who know the Swan, it's on the three levels. So they're delivering to three levels. And it really does work like that. But I had no idea that's what that was. That was Eric and the actors realizing, no, we can't. This cannot be small and private. This is, it's open rib cage, open heart, and it's out there, the whole thing. And I have to say, I'm incredibly proud of those actors, what they've done. They're a wonderful bunch.
There's just one thing that struck me, particularly hearing what you've said now about your frustration with contemporary playwriting, which in some ways explains your use of third person in particular. Of course, people have struggled to find a way of conveying subtext in theatre before, not least in expressionism in the 20s and 30s. And, you know, I think particularly in English of Eugene O'Neill, Strange Interlude, I think. But the difference there, and I particularly am aware of that difference, is that for O'Neill, obviously informed by psychoanalysis, was struck by the disjunction between that subtext, that inner feeling, and that public self.
Yeah.
But in your version, what you've wonderfully shown, as I think the great 19th century novelists show, is that actually those perspectives are all interconnected for the simple reason that we don't often understand motive, that motive, as you said a moment ago, is always complex.
Mm.
And I know you've heard me now say it so often, but I think that really is one of the reasons why, formally, what you've set out to do is, I think, so interesting and so different from earlier attempts to find alternatives.
It's the form seems to work. From the feedback we're getting, it does seem to work, and it seems to carry as a play. I suppose the thing, the worry for me was all the I say, you say, he says, was that going to carry? But actually, after about a minute, the audience seemed to forget. The I say becomes punctuation, becomes part of what's been said. And it doesn't stop. It seems to flow, and they don't notice it. Formally, I suppose I am interested in form. I've written another play in this kind of style as well, called Indigo, which the RSC they say they'll do it in 2017, and please God they will. So I am very, and it's something I want to take, and I think I've moved along further in that play than in Hecuba, because Hecuba was written 3 years ago. And that this other one was written a year and a half ago, and I'm working on another thing now. So I'm very interested in the possibilities of what you say is this form, how far it can be taken. What I love about it is if you set it up, it's almost like you can go anywhere with it. So you can go into a full-blown scene, you can have a little exchange, and you can pull it out again. So it's very elastic, and it gives you, and go that way. So I think there's more to be mined out of it. I'm just not sure what it is yet.
Well, that might be a good moment to open up to members of the audience. Does anyone have a question? Yeah.
The absence or presence of Helen a point on the contradictions of war, in the sense that both sides are convinced they're right?
Yes, it is. I always think Helen is Iraq. It's the excuse nations make up to go in and take what they're and do what they were going to do anyway. It's just a gloss on, it's just justification. Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, did I just talk now?
Yeah.
I don't know if that mic is working, is it?
Maybe. I just wanted to ask about the process of your involvement once rehearsals were underway. Were you very much just letting Erica and everyone involved, the designer and everyone, just go ahead, or did you intervene? How much did you stay involved with it once it was sort of, once you'd written it?
Quite involved, but more as an observer, because Erica is quite a seasoned director and knows what she's at, and they're a great crowd of actors. I mean, they're quite experienced, so there wasn't a lot for me to do. I did, however, enjoy very much being there, and there's always the odd half line, the odd phrase that can be cut or improved, stuff like that. So I was there for that. But mainly as an observer and supporter, really was my role in this one. I mean, there have been other rehearsals where you go in and it's war to the death. You're fighting tooth and claw with everyone. This wasn't one of them. It was a very good experience for me as a writer. There wasn't a whole lot to do. The play was written. So there weren't really, you know, there was a time concern at the beginning, because Erica didn't want an interval, and I didn't either. So at one point we thought that we might need to cut some of them. We cut some of them, but it went back in, because once the actors got au fait with the style of it, they speeded up. I mean, they took four, I think the third week of rehearsals, it was 40 minutes longer than it was on opening night. And that was all just stuff. That was actors figuring it out. One of the other things you realise, you cannot have any illustration in this play. It has to be completely on the line. Whatever you're doing, it has to be done on the line. You can't stop to think. Because if you stop to think, the audience will stop to think, and the whole thing just collapses like a house of cards. Because it's just... So it was a good experience.
I was just wondering, obviously Greek tragedy is famous for being really bloody and very violent. And I was really interested in how you were talking about the way you translate the character speaking Hecuba into present day, and thinking about that as a modern, you know, modern perspective. So how do you deal with violence and bloodshed, something that does seem so archaic in some ways, the way that our drama works now? So how do you translate that?
Do you mean how did that translate itself on stage physically?
No, as in how do you deal with that, like thinking that it's something that's very different how we think about drama, and like it doesn't
appear
on our stage in the same way now that it did. Like, did you think about that particularly, or like how did you kind of negotiate that as you were writing?
Well, I wouldn't shy away from it. I mean, there is a sacrifice scene, as you're aware. Polixen is sacrificed in Euripides' Hecuba. It's done off stage. Our sacrifice is done on stage. I'm not so sure. Yeah. Do we not see a lot of blood on stages now? I suppose no. There's a lot of blood in the stuff I write. So I mean, it's not something that that I have a problem with. But if I'm correct in getting what you're saying, portrayal of violence on stage, is that what you're asking about? And
yeah, how you translate what was something that's so different to how we see.
Yeah.
Now, how did you work with that? Sorry, very well phrased question.
Yeah, I think I just go with it. I mean, I have huge problems with blood. One of the things I love about the Greeks is the acclaim of where they wheel out the bodies, particularly in the Orestia, you know, where you've Clytemnestra there with her Lydian axe, and Agamemnon in the bath with the net, and Cassandra at her feet. I think that is probably more powerful than hacking someone to death on stage. I suppose I'd like, if I like my violence stylized, don't really go for the rivers of blood or whatever. Another way of dealing with that, and because as you say, there is such violence involved, is I think the way in which you write about it. So if it can be carried by several voices, if it can be suggested to the audience, so you start the image and the audience complete it, that to me is the most successful kind of theatre, rather than spoon feeding the audience and giving them the image, because it's never going to be what their image of that particular death or murder is. So I think if you can do it with language rather than having to show it literally, it's probably better.
Thank you. I just want to say how much I enjoy performance in Hecuba. I saw it last week, it was wonderful.
Thank you.
One of the most resonant things for me seeing it at Stratford was that it's being played in tandem with Henry V,
mm-hmm.
and that dialogue between the two plays was, and continues to be, something that I'm thinking about a lot. I wondered just how aware you were that that was going to happen, or whether that was something that was fortuitous, or... It
yeah.
just really intrigued me how much the two plays spoke to each other.
Yeah, me too. But it, obviously that had nothing to do with me. That was a matter of programming. But it was absolutely amazing to go and see Henry V and my own play on in The Swan. I've never had stiffer competition. it's a fantastic band, and the way both plays were directed and designed, they were complementary.
I'd say honours were even.
You take what?
The honours were even between the two plays.
Well, come on now. Henry V. And Alex, that he's absolutely astonishing, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Will you tell me about Agamemnon? From the opening scene, we're presented with this ruthless, uncompromising warrior. An impression really emphasised by the physique of Ray Fearon.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you looked tremendous and really scary. But it must be 12 occasions when Agamemnon says, "I am sorry." Now, is this genuine compassion? By a man who is in thrall to his coalition, commanders and armies, or is it cynical opportunism? Is he just bent on seduction and there's a sexual undertone from the very beginning? Or is he bent on plunder as well? I mean, what are you bringing out in this moment?
Well, Ray Fearon comes with his own enormous gifts. So what I was trying to do was give him a fair hearing. I think he's much maligned in the Odyssey and in Euripides and in the Oresteia. I just wanted to have a look at, the idea of head of this coalition who cannot agree on anything, that they don't believe he's the rightful king, really. That he's in Troy, the disappointment of victory as well. I wanted to look at that. The idea of not really knowing when you've won, and if you've won, is it worth it? What the cost of these victories? And that was in Henry V as well. You know, when they finally win, they don't even know that they've won. They have to be told by the enemy, actually, the day is yours. That and the idea of, I suppose, it's in Chalasso, the idea of the war bookended with the sacrifice of girls. So you have Iphigenia before they go to war, and you have Polyxena at the end of the war, and what that meant, and that he is involved in both. That was something that interests me as well. I suppose also echoing under Euripides' Hecuba is Agamemnon is going home to play out the Oresteia. So he's a doomed man in many ways. I also think, maybe I'm an innocent, but I think there are very few men who would want to slit their daughter's throat on an altar. I can't imagine one willingly offering to do that. I would imagine it a rigged oracle. I always think the oracle is like the Catholic Church. That it, you know, the word has come down, so the eagle is at the pregnant hare and tears them out. Now, to me, you could interpret that a million ways. Somehow it got interpreted that Artemis is upset, so you must sacrifice your daughter. I mean, how that could be, you know, I think the priests had their sides. I don't know, maybe I have a huge fantasy around it. I think at Aulis, the most famously windy place on earth, apparently, and there's no wind, or the wind, you never know what's going on with the wind in a Greek play. Is it blowing this way or that, or is it not blowing? The idea of the whole coalition there, the idea of Achilles, the idea of Agamemnon not being the rightful king, I'd say there was absolute war to the death there, and the rivalries between them. And I would say it was something as simple as, okay, we're going to get this guy in line. We're going to sort him out. He calls himself king. So, okay, this is what the king has to do for us to go, for us to go with you to Troy and plunder and destroy all around us. This is what you have to do. So you have to sacrifice your daughter. Probably thinking, no, that's a step too far. He's not going to do that. There's no way he's going to do that. And I would say out of... Yeah, he did it, whatever he found it in himself to do it. And they sailed to Troy. But he's carrying that with him, and he's bringing it home with him. So I always start, you know, I think if you're talking about the gods and the oracles and everything, I think it tends, this day and age, whatever our private beliefs are, and I would be a great believer, but no oracle is ever going to tell me what to do. It's like no Catholic Church has. Nobody on this earth has the mystery or the magic. The mystery is there. It's unknowable. So the idea of being dictated to by some oracle, I think we have to forget about that. Maybe all of that old knowledge is forgotten or whatever, but I still think they were human beings. They were walking the earth. They had the same passions as us. They had the same sorrows as us. They had the same conflicts, the same ethical questions as we had. And it's the only way I can understand him. I have to say I was slightly biased in his favour because he has got such bad press. So I thought, give him a chance. And that was the best I could do because there are a lot of cards stacked against him. So.
I was really, really interested in how you wrote Cassandra. I think she was one of the characters I enjoyed most watching. And it really made me think kind of psychologically, what would it do to somebody if they had all the knowledge of what was going to happen and saw those gruesome deaths that, you know, were in store for their family? And so I found it really interesting at the sacrifice scene where it's her, you know, kind of splattering the blood all over herself and her sisters being sacrificed. And I was just wondering if you could say a bit more about why her.
Why Cassandra? Well, because she knows, obviously.
Yeah.
I think Cassandra goes through a growing up in the journey of the story. What I love about these oracles, whatever, is that they usually get it wrong at some point. You know, they're accurate, but they're not that accurate. So I suppose that was one of the things that I was trying to deal with Cassandra, that she sees a certain amount, but she might have the timing wrong, or it might have been meant to have happened before, or she's not exactly sure what it is that she sees. Also the fact that none of the family pay her any attention. They just treat her like the mad daughter. The blood thing, and that was completely Erica's idea. That was a directorial decision, because she wanted some way to get across the idea that this sacrifice is happening. But the Nadia Albina, who plays Cassandra, is a very interesting actress, I think, and she brought great heart and depth to the character. And she's kind of the last of them, really. And you do get a sense, I mean, I get a sense dealing, you know, anytime you read the Greeks or whatever, is that we are actually playing out the legacy of Troy. That we're what's left because Troy is in rubble. And that something beautiful was buried in Troy, something that all of us let go, willingly or unwillingly. In some way, we're all responsible for that. And the new and harsher world that became Greece, that has become us, has become the future, that there was something in civilization ended there that we haven't yet picked up yet. That's what I'm not sure how I can explain that, but it's something I feel about. It's just a lofty place. Maybe I romanticize it, I don't know.
I was wonderfully transported by the play, and I loved every minute of it. I was intrigued by a thought that I had as well, but which I thought maybe part of your attitude towards writing that play, and that is you were pointing a finger at ourselves in terms of the Greeks always pointed fingers at themselves as a kind of democratic thing to do.
Mm.
And I saw it as being a very good way of doing it to us, to actually use the Greeks who had done it 2,700 years previously to do the same thing today.
Mm.
And I was intrigued also by the kind of strategy you put behind the brain of a man who can say one minute, I'm sorry, and the next minute is he would be saying, and where is your son?
Yeah.
Because I want to kill him.
Yeah, I know. It's carrying the contradiction, isn't it?
Yes.
And as Fiona was saying, the Greeks are fantastic in carrying contradiction in character and the complexity. But if you think about us, I mean, we're walking contradictions. We're not rational creatures. I mean, whoever said we were rational creatures? I think it wasn't until the age of enlightenment that anyone even assumed we were rational. And I think we suffer because of that.
Emotional.
We're passions. We're passions in motion. And that the idea that we do contradict ourselves left, right and centre, and I think to be allowed to do that, as long as it doesn't impact on anyone else's life, I suppose, is the thing. Civilization in the middle of it. And I suppose the Greeks, of all people, were trying to define civilization because they didn't know what it was. And yes, in a way, I think we're still trying to define how to behave in a civilized manner. I don't think we've figured it out. Unfortunately.
We've got three more questions and perhaps one more. I think there was one. can we try and keep our questions quite short? Not, I mean, we're okay
the answer short.
For 10 minutes, but then we might get thrown out. So.
To what extent is your contact with or inspiration from Greek drama mediated by other Irish writers like Kennelly and Healy, or from other non-Irish European writers like Ibsen and Strindberg? And do you think that one of the reasons why Greek tragedy, and especially Greek tragic heroines, has such an appeal for Irish writers and for Irish audiences is because just as if there was a phenomenon of the angry young man in the mid-20th century English stage raging against class divide, do you think that there's a similar sort of angry Irish woman?
Well, I wouldn't stop at Irish. I think women are just angry, full stop. I think we're very angry. I think we've a lot of right to be. That's a big question. Mediating through other playwrights, yeah. I mean, I read so much, I forget what I've read, so it all goes into the swill. But yeah, I love Ibsen, love Tennessee, Strindberg. You know,
the European playwrights, really.
Yeah, but Shakespeare as well, you know, but sure, he took from, you know. Yeah, they're all there, and it's just continuing the conversation as best you know how, and taking what you can.
Can I just ask if Sing is there anywhere in the mix?
Well, I love Sing, but I mean, I haven't read Sing in a couple of years, but I need to go back and have a look at him.
I was really impressed the way you use stage directions. There were actually the actors actually spoke the stage directions by you. Erica decided to use almost no props because We didn't see Priam's head, we didn't see the bodies. Did you do that on purpose? And also the thing that the actors narrate other characters' actions. So we had actually to imagine, we had the actual stage in front of us and another one in our imagination.
Yeah.
And we had to combine both.
Yeah.
And do you think, or does Erica think that that in a way, the characters narrating other characters' actions, like Kate Fowler narrating, it's a way to protect actors from bad performances? Because it's very difficult to perform a great tragic scene.
Yeah.
And not many actors are able to do that.
One of the technical things, I don't know, some of you may have noticed who saw it, was there's only one or two places where the actors actually do what the text says they do. They either do it before or after, or not at all. And I think that actually added a very, what you were saying, that you've, what's happening on stage, and then you have the freedom to make your own picture. You can imagine it the way you want. So kind of you can write your own play in a way, or write your own set of images or conjure them up. Yeah, that was deliberate. Yeah.
I think it's Oliver at the back and then I'll move forward.
I just wanted to ask you about one scene because nobody else has mentioned it. An incredibly strong scene is Dolores. Now this is a boy who has such extraordinary dignity, sensitivity about his mother. There's echoes of Cassandra from the Agamemnon. He sees his own death. When you wrote that, because it was a wonderful scene, I thought. When you wrote it, could you have been the boy I saw acting it? I think there must have been three of them altogether. Was astonishing.
Yeah.
And I wondered when you wrote that, could you have you confident you were going to get such amazing performance from such young actors?
Yeah, absolutely, Oliver, absolutely. And it's one of the arguments I have in theatre all the time, because I love to write children in plays. I think they are part of civilization. They're part of the world. They're there. And this idea, you know, it's surprising the amount of directors and actors as well who do not want to act with children, or directors who don't want to do plays, or theatre managements who won't do a play just because they're children there. I have absolute confidence. Those kids were magnificent, weren't they? They were just astonishing. Three young boys, Luca, Marcus, and Nile. And they were rehearsed within an inch of their lives. That's the other thing about the RSC. They have fantastic backup and support for performers, for writers, for everyone, you know, design, composers, the resources they put into their work. And I think it shows with the end product that there's great care taken. But yes, I have absolute confidence. But thank you for asking. Because it is important.
Hi.
Hello.
So what makes me love, thank you so much, and what you touch on, is that she's such a rich character. And I find with ancient characters, there's always a rush to kind of homage to them, which I'm still talking through this idea, but that's happening a lot. But would you consider your Hecuba to have a form? And if so, do you think she has a homage?
Does she have a flaw? I think she has many flaws, yeah. I think she has huge problems with Cassandra. I think she's probably a vain woman. I think she's quite arrogant. Does she have a hamartia? Well, I think she... No, I think there are sometimes a set of circumstances that are just completely outside of your control. You know, one of the things they said about the Trojans, you probably know this, your classic students, but that they never saw it coming, and that they were too weak, and they were too perfect, and they were too arrogant. And that they didn't have a navy, they didn't have the big ships. They were a trading city mainly, city of light, and so everyone came through them, and there were taxes from all the ships coming through, but that they never saw it coming. But then you have to say, who could no one could withstand that kind of savagery. I don't think Hecuba is a victim, but I do think she has been asked. Some people, I think, in their lives, they're just asked to suffer too much. And there doesn't seem to be any logic to it. And then other people, they have their hamartia, they get their comeuppance, and then other people just seem to have charmed lives. And it seems to have very little to do with morality or the idea of leading the good life, which makes it kind of fills you with despair, because basically we're down to personal virtue in this age. You know, the big belief systems have more or less crumbled, well, in the West anyway. So you're down to personal virtue and the idea of the wheel turning. So nothing happens but the wheel turns. So if you're good to people, people will be good back to you. If you're good to someone else's children, someone will be good to your children. That kind of thing. You meet someone like Hecuba and all of that just crumbles. In Oedipus the same. In the book of Job the same. It's like personal virtue counts for nothing. Goodness counts for nothing. And I think it's one of the most difficult things for us to grapple with, the idea of personal virtue and the idea of being good just for the sake of it, not because you're going to get something out of it or not because it's the right thing to do.
Hi. I just wondered, to someone who doesn't have much experience of Greek theatre, reading it, where would you recommend a good starting point? Sorry,
probably
nothing to
do today. Ask Fiona, where would you start? Start with Oedipus.
Yeah, okay.
Can't go with it. It's all Oedipus, the RSI, that's kind of it, really. Every other play that's been written is somehow has to deal sooner or later. You're stuck with Oedipus and the RSI. We haven't got past them. It's all in there.
I think that was a wonderful place to end, and I have a feeling that perhaps in 10 years' time we'll be inviting Marina back to talk about further engagement with various ancient plays. In fact, I know for sure we will. What strikes me is 2.5 millennia of a revenge tragedy has been overturned by this woman. She, as Lynn reminded us, was privileged and stood her ground in a repertoire with Shakespeare's Henry V, and instead of giving us men's war, gave us women's war. And instead of Hecuba, the figure of revenge, as she was, particularly in the early modern period, and clearly, as people have argued, for Shakespeare in particular, and perhaps Hamlet, Hecuba is lurking in many, many ways behind Hamlet and Hamlet's dilemma. He's given us, I think, an extraordinary tragedy of survival, and Hecuba, above all, has survived. As we've discussed, I mean, survival not only comes at personal cost, but also very often at huge cost to others. And I think you reminded us with your figure of Hecuba that surviving and surviving with dignity often means that one loses one's dignity on the way. So in all senses, and I think the sort of conversations that have begun here in this room, you know, this has been a very special work, and it's been, you know, a huge privilege to us that you've come to speak about that today. Now, before you formally thank Marina, we invite you all to join us for a cup of tea over in the common room. So please do. And Marina, I know, is going to be here for at least another hour before she has to dash to Heathrow. So please ask more. But thank you, Marina, very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.